I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the Prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we conclude our investigation into the disappearance of Amy Bechtel. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, with my extraordinary co-host, Alice.
Alliterative from last time. I think it was enigmatic. Now it's extraordinary.
It was enigmatic. It was. Now you're extraordinary. I think I've used extraordinary before, but it fits you so well, I've decided just to
stick with it. Oh, that's so kind. Well, I'm really glad to be back because, man, when we left off yesterday, I just couldn't believe how little evidence there was. And unfortunately, I think we haven't discovered more evidence between yesterday and today, but there is a lot more to discuss.
No, we don't have a whole lot of evidence to add, unfortunately. This is a case that just startling. I mean, it's shocking, amazing, really, how little evidence there is in this case. And I keep hoping we're wrong about that. I'm hoping people are, you know, getting mad, even as we say it, and thinking, there's so much more evidence, and why aren't you talking about this? And they're emailing us. But if that's the case, you know, we look forward to sharing that with the world, because up to this point, that doesn't seem like there's been a lot. But as Alice said, today we're going to continue looking into the investigation of Amy Bechtel. And hopefully, in doing so, we can uncover some evidence and maybe jog somebody's memory and start heading down the right path in this case.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. So at 10:30, Steve calls the sheriff's office, and he leaves that sort of unusual message, or doesn't leave it. He speaks to somebody, and that's what he says. Now, everything Steve's done up to this point strikes me as a concerned husband. So I just want to say, I don't think he was showing a lack of concern in what he said. I think he was just trying to stay calm and not overreact and not freak out. But he calls the sheriff. At the same time, his next door neighbors, who, like I said, were their very close friends, one of them was a very good rock climber who climbed with Steve often. They head off to the loop road to see if Amy went there to mark out her race, because they knew she was going to do that. And, you know, putting two and two together, sort of using that circumstantial evidence we talk about sometimes, they concluded that's probably where she was. They went out there, and sure enough, they find Amy's car, and they think, yay, we've done it. We found her car. It's going to be fine. You know, maybe she had a flat tire. Maybe she ran out of gas. This'll be it. But when they walk up to her car, they realize there's nobody there. Now, it's taken them till about 1 o'clock in the morning to find this car. At this point, they call Steve on their cell phone. They tell him they found the car, and the search begins immediately. We talked about this. I mean, they are on top of it. And there are 25 people out there that night, most of them expert outdoorsmen who are looking for her through the night. And honestly, if you listen to what some of the search and rescue people and the sheriff said about this case, they fully expected that she would be found that night, that they would walk down one of those trails and they would find her with a broken leg or a twisted ankle or whatever, and she would be rescued. And so it actually comes as a surprise to a lot of people that they don't find her.
Can I say that I don't think I could get 25 people out of bed in the middle of the night to search for me?
No way.
So no way. I mean,
it'd
this
be
goes
like you and my wife.
We would come for you, Brett. We would
maybe.
Certainly.
I mean,
come
I'm assuming you'd be there.
I will definitely be like, there. I mean, I might like finish, you know, a sleep cycle and then I'll come. But No, but I think it says, you know, the type of person that Amy was, because she probably would have done this for her friends as well. And like you said, they're showing up right then in the middle of the night. They're not waiting till the morning because they just assume, of course, we're going to find her. Amy's a pro at this. She knows these trails. She's just caught up somewhere. Must be a broken leg. She can't get out. She's waiting for us to come, so we're coming for her.
And by the next day, the sheriff's office is fully mobilized. They've expanded the search area to a 20 to 30 mile radius of the car, which, just think about that. That's insane. That's a huge search area.
Especially because they expect that she's just been running, and she was just going to run a 10K, right? She wasn't going for a 30 mile run. So for them to do this is really exhaustive and thorough.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to find this girl. That's what they're thinking. We're going to find her, whatever it takes. And they're bringing in helicopters. They've got the infrared devices that are looking for heat signatures. You've got helicopters from the Air Force Base nearby joining the search. By the next day, July 28th, you've got 80 searchers combing the area around Fry, Fiddlers, and Lewis Lakes. They're on horseback. They're on all-terrain vehicles. They are now. You've got another helicopter from the Bureau of Indian Affairs that's joined the search. A dozen four-wheel all-terrain vehicles. Now, it's raining, and that hampers progress, but this just tells you how committed these people are to finding Amy.
That's right. And now, on July 29th, authorities begin to consider the possibility of foul play and discuss expanding the search to include places where a body could possibly be hidden, such as in caves, old cabins, mines, and culverts. And, you know, Brett, I think they start to consider possibility of foul play because, as we've talked about, this is incredibly exhaustive. It's almost unthinkable that they haven't found her if she was just going for a run and got lost somewhere, right? Now they're like, this isn't right. The, you know, things are not adding up. We think that something may be more at play here.
And I'll say this, I'm one of the first people in a case like this to say, I think they just wandered off and died, right? I mean, it is so easy to do. People underestimate it. We talked about this with Maura Murray. People underestimate how easy it is to get lost in the wilderness, number one, and number two, how hard it is to find somebody. And that is certainly true here in the Shoshone National Forest. And it is certainly the case that the search and rescue people have said openly that it's possible she's still out there. But I don't believe it. I think with all the effort they put into it as quickly as they did, I mean, this is not 5 days later. This is immediately. This is, I don't care how fast Amy is and what she was trying to do. She could not have escaped the search that's going on here if she was just wandering around in those woods. They would have found her. That I feel absolutely confident about that.
And by July 31st, reporters are told the area is now considered a crime scene, and the search for Amy is scaled back as the possibility of foul play becomes more likely. The command post stationed on the Loop Road is moved to the sheriff's office to centralize efforts, and some 25 agents from the FBI and State Department of Criminal Investigation join the investigation. Brett, we do a lot of investigations. Have you ever had a case with 25 agents?
It's insane. I just want to keep going back to this. There are some problems with this investigation, and they really begin now. There are people who are involved with this who screw some things up, but it is certainly the case that they took this seriously. And the amount of manpower that was dedicated to finding her is striking.
And part of it, you know, we're just talking about the PR side of it. Why does this missing person case have 25 agents? I don't know for a fact, but I imagine because this captured the attention of the nation, and we said earlier, in 1997, everyone knew Amy's name, that each agency probably wanted to be the one to recover Amy, to solve the mystery. And that's probably why there are so many agents on the case, because you have kind of competing agencies who want to be the, you know, glorious agency that recovers her.
Right. And we talk about this sometimes, you know, the missing white girl syndrome, where when someone like Amy, young, attractive, athletic, white, goes missing, there's a huge focus on it. And a lot of times people who don't fit all of those categories, when they go missing, nobody notices. I don't know if that had anything to do with this, but certainly people were intrigued and people were interested, and all the resources that could go to this went to it. And up till this point, everybody was working together and everybody was on the same team. But on August 5th, 1997, things begin to change. And it's on that day when the sheriff's office brings in Steve to question him. This is not unusual. We've talked about this before. The husband's always the first person you have to eliminate. And so you have to bring him in and you won't talk about everything. And even if you don't think they're a suspect, they may have information that even they don't realize they have. He might have known something about Amy's movements that day that could have been helpful, her habits, anything. So they spent about 3 hours talking to him. And as we said, when we went through the timeline, Steve can account for his movements that day, pretty much all of them. And he has people, lots of different people, who can confirm his alibi. And he says, look, my wife and I were happy. We were newlyweds. We had come here to live our dream. And that's when something very strange happens. It's not that strange, but I question this tactic in this circumstance. An officer comes in with a thick folder of papers. And as reported by Runner's Magazine, which has a fantastic story on this, we'll link to it on the website. You totally should read it. He says to Steve, I've been in this business 23 years, and I'm a pretty good judge of character. We know you were responsible for your wife's disappearance. Here's the evidence to prove it. And then he drops that folder of papers on the table in front of Steve and then demands that Steve take a polygraph. Steve, as he tells it, is completely stunned. He is shocked by this. It's the first time anybody has mentioned the possibility that he could be a suspect. And so what does he do? He does exactly what he should do. He asks for a lawyer. He says he'll take the polygraph, but he wants to have a lawyer. He hires a lawyer, and the lawyer tells him, you're not taking a polygraph. That's crazy. So he doesn't take a polygraph, and the next day, the police arrive at his house with a search warrant.
That's a bully tactic if I ever heard one.
Yeah, I mean, they are definitely bracing him. That officer must have decided, I'm going to make him break. And so he does this thing. And number one, Steve doesn't break. And number two, this drives a wedge between Steve and the police department that, frankly, has never been fixed.
So, I mean, I don't know if we'll go into it again this time, but you guys know what we think about polygraph tests. They're not admissible as evidence in court. And we've told you that we would probably not take polygraph tests either, just because they're based on biometrics. They're not reading your mind. And there are so many reasons a test, you could fail a test. And it may not be because you're lying. And there's also ways that you can beat a test. And so, you know, he's not the first person to be advised not to take a polygraph test. And it sounds like he was willing to take it at first, but it was his counsel who told him not to do so. Now, the police do have a search warrant. We've talked about this before, that because of your constitutional rights, the police can't just come into your house and search. They need to first go to a judge, and they have to show probable cause in order to get a search warrant for, in this case, Steve's house. So apparently a judge...
pretty flimsy in this case.
Yeah, I was going to say, we haven't seen the search warrant. Usually those are sealed. But we can talk about what we think the probable cause is based on, and I think it's quite, quite flimsy. I'm not sure many judges would have signed it based on the evidence that we know of.
I mean, what I have heard, and whether it's true or not, is they really put a lot of stock in that witness that we talked about earlier who claimed to have seen a truck matching Steve's with a woman matching Amy in the passenger seat. And that was a huge piece of evidence they used to get this search warrant. And I just don't know about that.
So typically you'd have to, even if that seemed like a good witness, you typically have to corroborate it because, like we've said, just one piece of evidence or just one eyewitness can be faulty. You would probably need something else, like the friend So he was on the phone with a friend, and that person could hear a car, that he seemed to be driving a car. That could be corroboration, or someone could put him at the canyon as opposed to at his house. You know, you typically need something more than just one piece of evidence. Otherwise, think about this. Any Yahoo can come forward and claim some sort of testimony in order to help the police get a search warrant for, say, their worst enemy. So that's why we don't go by that.
It seems pretty flimsy to me, but they got one.
Well, and police officers do what they do when they have a search warrant. They execute the search warrant at Steve's house on August 6th, 1997. And when they do it, they seize his truck and his journals. And remember, Steve had refused to take that polygraph, and he would later explain, if law enforcement had just said, Steve, we know you didn't have anything to do with Amy's disappearing, let's just take the poly as a formality, I would have taken it in a second. And that's what Brett was saying, that because of the way the interrogating officer acted, there was really this wedge between Steve and the police, and it probably didn't help move the ball forward in terms of finding Amy. And, you know, Steve does explain, I wouldn't take the test under any circumstances. He notes, it's deeply flawed and completely unreliable. You could show the exact same results to two so-called experts, and one will say the subject's being truthful, and the other will say he's lying. And as Brett and I have told you before, we agree with him.
I think polygraphs can be useful for a lot of things, but this sort of popular imagination that it's going to tell you whether or not this guy killed his wife, it's just not true.
Yeah. And so from that point forward, Steve would be the public's main suspect.
And this really split the town of Lander. There were people who thought Steve absolutely did it. There were people who thought he didn't have anything to do with it. I think one thing that's interesting, Steve's friends, the people who knew him best and who knew Amy best, were completely behind him. They never wavered in their support for him. And look, I get it. Sitting here in my chair, in my, you know, perfect life, if somebody said to me, would you take a polygraph test if it meant maybe helping find your missing wife, if something like that were to happen, I would say, of course I would, right? But when you're in Steve's position, and it's obvious the police have decided you had something to do with it, and your lawyer tells you not to take the test, it's hard to blame him for not taking it.
Right, because at that point, you think the narrative is already written for the police, and they're just looking for one more thing. They'll use a failed test or a passed test to help their narrative. If he passes it, they may say, Steve is this mastermind who can even beat a polygraph. And if he fails it, they'll say, see, we told you, he lied about it. He's responsible for Amy's disappearance.
Exactly. So they do this search by August 20th. The sheriff's saying they didn't really find anything, that much of the evidence they collected would only be used in case they needed to identify a body. They did find some journals, and we'll talk about those in a second, but otherwise, not much from that. On August 23rd, the weirdest thing that happens in this case happens. Pictures are requested from NASA, from the Russian space station Mir, who apparently informs NASA. I mean, this just tells you how far and wide this story got. NASA, or the Mir space station, and query why they were doing this, was apparently attempting to take pictures of this area, the Burnt Gulch Loop Road area, that day. And so somebody decided, hey, they might have photos that would be helpful of Amy. Unfortunately, it turns out it was too cloudy that day for the photos to actually be useful. But I mean, that's the only time I've ever seen that in a case.
I can promise you, if I go missing, NASA's not going to be helping.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
I'm not important enough.
Crazy fast. Oh, that's not true.
But I mean, you're right though. These are incredible lengths. I don't know of an investigation to go to all these lengths.
Right. I know. It's just insane. So by September 28th, that's when the 10K was supposed to be held, the one that Amy was mapping out. They hold it as a way to, you know, continue interest in her case. investigators thought they might have had a lead. They had heard of a gentleman who allegedly had been possibly stalking Amy before this happened and before she moved to Lander. But unfortunately, he was in jail at the time. So that's a really good alibi when you're in jail.
That's a really good one.
Then fast forward. I mean, that's 1997. Fast forward all the way to 2003, and we have really the only piece of maybe evidence that's ever really found, and that's a Timex Iron Man digital watch. It was discovered by a doctor hiking in the area, and he turned it into police. The watch was similar to a watch Bechtel owned at the time of her disappearance, but unfortunately, law enforcement was unable to determine whether or not the watch belonged to her, and frankly, I bet everybody in Lander had a Timex Iron Man digital watch. I mean, these are all outdoorsmen. These are all people who would have that kind of watch. So I just don't know how helpful even that is. And the search for Amy has continued for years and years and years. At one point, the reward for her grew to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Eventually, her family dedicated that to some scholarships, and Amy's never been found.
I really can't believe that we have so little evidence in this case despite all of that investigation.
I think it's the least reward for the most effort I've seen in any of these cases, and that you're going to see. Like we said, usually what you see in these cases is people don't realize it's serious until it's too late. The searches aren't organized until it's too late. When they are organized, they're not really big enough to cover the amount of territory they have to cover, and they're made up of people who have no idea what they're doing, and that's just not the case here. So,
right.
So that's the timeline. We can move on to some of the unusual aspects in this case, and I'll start with the first one, which is just crazy.
Yeah, and I was going to say, there are some weird aspects of this case for sure.
This one's totally weird to me. This just shows you how small a world it is.
It gives me chills. I don't like this particular unusual aspect. It's too scary for me.
Yeah. So let's talk about Carrie Swenson. So Carrie Swenson, like Amy, was a world-class athlete. In fact, she was a world champion biathlon. And she was kidnapped on a training run, not unlike what we're talking about here, in 1984 by two Montana survivalists, Don and Dan Nichols, father and son, and they had intended to use her for what has been described as breeding purposes.
Oh my gosh.
So a massive search was launched to find her, and rescuers apparently stumbled upon this camp where the survivalists were, I guess, as Don was performing the marriage ceremony between Dan and Carrie, because, you know, you got to get married if you're going to be breeding. The rescuers tried to intervene. One of the rescuers was actually shot and killed, and Carrie was shot point blank as well before she was eventually freed. I think Don was killed and Dan went to jail for quite some time, or they're both in jail, or one of them went to jail for a long time, one of them's been recently released. But the weird thing, it's weird that there's all those similarities between this story. Amy Bechtel, the fitness center that she worked at, was actually owned by Carrie's cousin. So there is a strange connection to that very unusual story, and it has some eerie similarities to Amy's disappearance.
Right. You know, but they are more than a decade apart, and they are in two different states, but it is very eerie how similar they are, except that, of course, Amy has never been found. And as far as I know, they did not stumble across any survivalist camps in the Shoshone National Forest.
No.
So let's talk about Steve's journals that we talked about. They were seized by law enforcement when they executed the search warrant. So we don't have access to Steve's journals. They've never been released to the public, and only select excerpts are available. And the journals stretched all the way back to his high school days. So he's a journaler. And people who journal, I mean, that's what you do. You keep a record of everything. I aspire to be a journaler, but I actually am terrible at it. Yeah.
Me too.
If you got my journals, you would not know what happened day to day, for sure. But, you know, Steve liked to write down things, and it wasn't just what happened day to day. His journals contained song lyrics and musings, many of which contained violent overtones describing violence towards women and even Amy. And according to Amy's family, who has seen these journals, the journals deeply disturbed them. Now, Steve claims that these journals, they're just fictional short stories that he wrote. But, you know, we'll just read you one of the lines from one of these excerpts. One line was, "Power is the ultimate aphrodisiac." And it has been reported that Steve's journals contained entries that outlined his need for dominance and control, as well as an undated poem that contemplated how to murder someone and hide their remains.
Yeah.
Man. I mean, even if these are short stories, here's one thing I will note about Steve. You know, we haven't talked much about Steve. All we know so far that we've told you is that Steve is an outdoorsman, right? He likes rock climbing. He hasn't been described as like a creative type writer, right? You know, we talked about Ray Rivera, who was the creative type. He wrote screenplays and he would jot down ideas, and it would make sense if you found his journal that they would be musings and short stories. But Steve, that's not what he does. Remember, his dream was to own a fitness center, a gym, with Amy, not to, say, teach literature at the college level. So it doesn't mean that, you know, some outdoors person can't have creative outlets in writing, but this just isn't something that we know of Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say about it. I really don't. This is the worst piece of evidence against Steve. It's the piece of evidence that keeps people coming back to him. The timeline just doesn't really fit, and it seems like he has an alibi, and there's no suggestion that Steve hired, you know, a hitman or something to kill Amy. And so on the one hand, maybe they are just fictional stories, right? Maybe they are just song lyrics. Or maybe he's not a nice guy. I mean, that's also possible, right? Maybe he's a male chauvinist. Maybe he was a jerk. Maybe he was abusive. We're going to talk about that in a second. I don't know what to make of these.
Here is one thing, though, Brett. If, in fact, the search warrant was based on that one eyewitness who saw a truck that may have matched Steve's, I think there would be a strong case to suppress the fruits of an illegal search. And the only reason the police have these journals is because of that search warrant. So
that's a good point.
If this were to go to trial, I think there probably would be a good case for Steve's attorney to keep the journals out. And like you said, this is really kind of the only evidence, bad evidence against him. So I'm not sure it would even come into play in a legal case against him.
And we've talked about this before. They call it the fruit of the poisonous tree in the law. If your search warrant is invalid, then anything you find as a result of that search warrant is not allowed. And like Alice said, the only reason they found these was because of that search warrant. And I think you do have to question whether that search warrant would hold up if it was challenged in court.
Right.
So, but they did find these. I mean, whether it would hold up in court, the public certainly knows about these. Now, the excerpts have never really been released, other than that "power is the ultimate aphrodisiac" line. I would love to see some more of these. But I wasn't able to find any, and I don't think that they're generally available. One interesting thing that came out of this was the police did allow the family to see these. And after hearing the information, Amy's brother said he recalled an incident when Amy and Steve had come over to their house, and he had noticed that Amy had a pretty serious bruise on her arm. And he asked her, "What's the deal with that?" And she laughed it off and said that Steve could get a little rough sometimes. And her brother, who's named Nails, began to believe that Steve was dominating Amy. And her reaction to that kind of confirmed it, because that was not her. As Steve said, "Amy just laughed it off and would not look me in the eye. And I said, that is not a normal reaction, particularly for Amy." And so the family, at this point, they have really come to believe that Steve was domineering, that he had controlled Amy, that he had a need for control. And I think that has led them, once again, to have some serious, serious concerns about Steve.
And, you know, I think it's important to note that I don't think the family thought this of Steve until they saw the journals, right? So, again, we say that the mind is very impressionable. And the brother, you know, Nels remembers this incident with the bruise after he sees the journal entries. And he's known about this bruise incident for a while, and he never thought to bring up that maybe Steve was abusive. So how much stock you put into this, I think it really just depends, because you start fitting a narrative based on what evidence you have before you.
No, I think that's 100% right. And we've talked about this before, and Alice just mentioned it. There is a problem with confirmation bias. And when you start adding evidence to sort of preconceived notions, you ignore everything else and all that you remember. I mean, all that he probably remembers about Steve at this point and their interactions were times when it was negative and when it seemed like Steve was overbearing. And you totally understand that. And maybe that's the way Steve was, but it's just awfully shaky. It's not a lot to build a murder case on, particularly, as we said before, when the timeline just doesn't seem to work. Now, one thing I thought was interesting is it seems like Amy's wallet was missing. We said this before. There's no struggle at the car. All of her items are still there. The keys are still there. But her wallet was missing. And I just don't know if you would take your wallet with you on a long run like that. I'm not a distance runner. Like I said, I get about a half mile in and I'm ready to stop, but I certainly would not have my wallet with me. And I think for the same reasons that Alice was saying, you'd leave your car, your keys behind, I would think you would leave your wallet too.
I totally agree with you. So, you know, when I run, I forget what they're called. It's essentially a very, very thin fanny pack. Like it fits flush against your skin. You can't see it, you know, through your running clothes, and it's basically a spandex zipper, and you put the bare minimum you need. So when I would go for runs, I would put like a single house key and my ID in case, in fact, I like somehow hit my head and became unconscious and someone found me. But that was it. I did not carry a bulky wallet with me because I didn't want anything weighing me down. And here's the thing. Even if she had left her wallet behind in her car and you think, well, her car was unlocked, someone just came by, took advantage of the unlocked car and stole it, that makes no sense, because if you're going to steal the wallet, why not just steal the car, which is probably more valuable? The keys are right there. Or why not take more things than just the wallet? Or take the cash, leave the wallet, and maybe the person never notices that you took their cash, right? Because there's a lot of things in a wallet that the typical thief doesn't need. They don't actually need your license. They don't actually need your AAA card or, you know, what have you. They're probably looking for credit cards and cash.
And here's the thing. What are the chances that two different people are going to be out in the Shoshone National Forest looking to do, you know, evil that day, and one's killing her somewhere and the other one's breaking into her car and stealing something? I think if the wallet has anything to do with this, it was probably taken by the same person who killed Amy.
Yeah. Hey, so, I mean, let's say someone did kill her. Why take her wallet then? Because if you leave the wallet behind, it makes it that much more mysterious. Whenever you see a wallet missing, you immediately think some sort of a robbery or some sort of bad thing has happened. So I'm not even sure if I'm trying to get away with this, I would take the wallet.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? There's all sorts of reasons I guess you might do it. Maybe you tell her, look, grab your wallet, we'll go to the bank, you're going to get all your money out, and I'll let you go, right? And that way she comes along peaceably without you having to fight her. I mean, I don't know exactly why they would take the wallet, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, who knows what happened to the wallet? It's all speculation, but it is weird to me that the wallet's missing, just because I think the presumption's always been that Amy was picked up somewhere on that road, not near her car, that she never returned to her car. So if she left her wallet, where's her wallet, you know? So, I don't know. It's a weird one to me, but maybe it doesn't mean anything. Maybe it does.
Yeah, maybe there's an easy answer to it, but nothing seems obvious right now. Now, this some people point to as being an unusual aspect, but I think it's probably blown out of proportion. So in 2004, now that is, what, 7 years after Amy goes missing, Amy is declared...
So that's the minimum, so...
It's the minimum, right. Amy is officially declared dead, and they do that for lots of purposes, closure for the family, for closing out cases, those sorts of things. And shortly after she's officially declared dead, Steve remarries, and he has two children.
And I think the reason she was declared dead is because Steve wanted to get married again. I think this was Steve's decision.
And some people, if they're already in the narrative that Steve was the one who, you know, killed Amy, this can be a sexy theory. He wanted to off her so that he could get married 7 years later. You know, I don't know. That
right.
He was very, they were very young. They were like 24. I think it's totally understandable that a 24-year-old would want to remarry.
And what's Steve supposed to do at this point? I mean, Amy has either ran away, you know, which she didn't do, or she's been killed. I mean, there's no real in between, right? I mean, there's no, it's difficult to imagine a scenario in which Amy is out there somewhere alive. So what is Steve supposed to do? Is he just supposed to stay married to her for the rest of his life? Is he never supposed to declare her dead? Is he supposed to get a divorce, which seems even worse to me?
Right.
So, I mean, I know it upsets people, but Steve had to move on at the end of the day. And he deserves to be able to move on, assuming he didn't kill her.
Right. So, and so I don't think it's that unusual, to be honest.
No, I agree with you 100%. So look, we've given you basically no evidence about what happened in this
That's
case.
Why it's so hard.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about some theories anyway. And, you know, I would start with aliens, but I don't even know. There's not even any alien evidence in this
case. There isn't.
You know, there's not even any, like, lights in the sky or anything. I mean, we had people out there around Burnt Lake, and there's nobody who said they saw, you know, little gray men running around or anything. So I don't think it was aliens. You know, if you're a fan of the 411 theories, maybe it was Bigfoot. We are out in Wyoming, so whatever. But whether you think she was killed by Bigfoot or killed by a mountain lion, there's no evidence of it. Now, that is one thing I think we can say for certain. If Amy was attacked on the trail by a mountain lion or a grizzly bear or Bigfoot or Loch Ness Monster or whatever, they would have found evidence of that. They'd have found blood. They'd have found a struggle. They would have found her body. They'd have found something. And they didn't find that. So I think we can go ahead and just knock out wildlife. Wildlife didn't do it. So what do you think, Alice? Did Steve do it?
I agree with you that wildlife probably didn't attack her, but we've talked about how wildlife can really do a number on the remains of a person. So do you think that if she had been, if there were no struggle, so whether she fell into a ditch and somehow died or someone killed her and she was out there for, for decades, do you think wildlife could have basically eaten her body to the point where there would be nothing left for searchers to recover?
I mean, I think, yeah, at this point. I think if she was out there and they didn't find her, I mean, there's not a whole lot left. And maybe you find a skull eventually. Maybe.
And I ask that kind of leading because I think, yes, possibly. That is a possible thing. And I say that because probably some people are going to write to us and say, well, wildlife could have eaten away everything, all the evidence. But remember how extensive that search was? It takes time for wildlife to do their work. And if she were nearby and had fallen, you know, into a ditch or something, I think they would have covered it before wildlife, you know, disposed of the entire body.
And this is and another thing about this case. If you think she just disappeared into the wild, this is not a case like Brandon Lawson or Mara Murray or, you know, Brandon Swanson, where people disappear in the middle of nowhere in a place that people don't often go. And if they ended up in a particular spot and you didn't find their body on the initial search, maybe you never find their body. People are all over this place all the time. If anybody was ever going to stumble upon a body, it would be in this case. So even if they didn't find her initially, I've got to think if she were out there, even if her bones were spread all over the place, that somebody would have found her. by now. I mean, just go back to Mytrese Richardson, right? I mean, Mytrese Richardson was in an almost entirely inaccessible place when they found her body. But they found her body. It took a year, but they found it. And I just feel like if she was out there, somebody would have found her by now.
Yeah, I was actually specifically thinking about Mytrese Richardson and, you know, how her bones were scattered, but they were there.
Right, right. And so that brings us to Steve.
Did Steve do it? I think we just don't have any evidence. The only evidence we have is something that I think is not even admissible because it was fruits of an illegal search. So, and not having seen the entire journal, I think is very difficult because as we know all the time, if things are taken out of context, they can really be twisted. So I have no idea what surrounds the power is the ultimate aphrodisiac line. You know, it really could be a short story, and it becomes clear when you read it in context that it's a short story. So I think there's just so little evidence. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
You saw that in The Staircase where Kathleen Peterson's sisters are going through everything Michael Peterson ever wrote, trying to say, oh, look at what he wrote here. This means he's a killer or whatever. And that's just not necessarily the case. And look, I just can't get past Steve's alibis. Everybody in the world is an alibi for Steve. And there are people who say, well, he was a member of the rock climbing community and those people are really tight and they cover for each other. Like, whatever. Nobody,
I don't think they're going to
kill. Do not cover for murderers. Okay.
And here's the thing. Amy's part of that community. They also love Amy. Remember her 25 friends who showed up at 1 a.m. to search for her? So it's not like everyone loved Steve and hated Amy. They loved both of them.
Right. That's absolutely right. And if those people, those same people who were out there in the middle of the night searching for Amy say, Steve was with me rock climbing, or Steve was at home refusing my pizza invitation, or Steve was on the phone with me, that's what Steve was doing. And the idea that Steve could pull off this murder and dispose of Amy's body in a way that it was never found despite all this scrutiny, it just doesn't make sense. The only way it would work is if he did it in the morning and the whole trip to the rock climbing wall was really, he was going to dispose of her body and then do that and have the perfect alibi. But we just know that didn't happen because people saw Amy all over the place. So I just don't know how it could be Steve. And if you're somebody who thinks it's Steve, I want you to email in and explain to us how it's Steve. I want you to tell me how it could be Steve that did this, because frankly, I don't see it. I don't see it. And I want to see it. So I mean, I don't want to see it, but it would be nice to have Steve as a viable suspect, but he's just not. He's just not.
Yeah. I mean, based on the evidence and the timeline and his alibi and others who are able to corroborate his alibi, it's hard to see without some, you know, completely scene-altering evidence how Steve is the killer.
So the last theory we have, and I think it's a good one, though whenever you start pointing to serial killers, it's a little weird because it just feels a little too sensational. But that's a gentleman, and I won't call him a gentleman, scumbag named Dale Wayne Eaton. And Dale Wayne Eaton is thought by most people to be the Great Basin Killer. He was a serial killer who was active in the area at the time and is most likely responsible for the murders of at least 9 women in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada between 1983 and 1997. So right after Amy went missing and before Dale Wayne Eaton, anybody knew who he was, his brother told the police that he and Dale would often camp in the Burnt Gulch area. And then his brother was there around the time that Amy went missing. So that happens. And he says that. And the police write it down somewhere, but they don't think a lot of it. Well, a month after Amy goes missing, Eaton tries to kidnap a family that had stopped for car trouble. So he basically, and this is kind of a great story when you read it, he kidnaps these people and he's in the back seat. And I think he pulls out a gun or something and he's trying to kidnap them. And then basically the wife like wrecks the car and then they just beat the crap out of him. Right. And he gets arrested. And while he's arrested, people realize there's some DNA tests or fingerprinting or whatnot, and they realize that he killed, raped, and murdered a young lady named Lisa Marie Kimmel in 1988. Kimmel was killed while driving through Wyoming, and her body was found in a river. And eventually, this is crazy, her car, Eaton had buried her car on
How?
His property. So that's
how
where her car was buried. It's just, I don't know. It's
how the heck do you bury a car?
So he was convicted. He's been on death row. He's kind of been off and on death row because he keeps getting new appeals that vacate his death sentence. Investigators have talked to him. They kind of feel like if his death sentence ever becomes more solid, that he'll have a reason to talk to them and maybe he would admit to this. But so far, his position has been he's not going to talk to the cops about anything. So he's a good suspect. If he was in the area and he's a murderer, he's a good suspect.
He's a really good suspect. Like you said, typically serial killer theories, I think, are just so sensational that they probably are not real. But the fact that they weren't able to say, they actually solved Lisa Kimmel's rape and murder by accident, really, 6 years after her death, says something, right? They didn't even know to look for him. He seems to be very good at his profession of being a serial killer, burying a car.
In fact, yeah, he buried the car, so he's good at hiding things. He knows how to hide things. And the fact that her body was found in a river, I think, is significant because, you know, if that body is never found in the river, if it just floats out to the sea and is gone, then maybe they never solve that case.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you got to wonder if maybe Amy's body ended up in a river somewhere.
And here's the thing. The way that there is no trace of Amy almost suggests that it has to be someone who knows what they're doing. You know, he's gotten away, at least, you know, he probably has gotten away with a lot more murders than we even know about because, you know, people think that he's responsible for at least 9 women who were murdered in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada between a span of 1983 to 1997. I mean, that's quite prolific. And who knows if it's one person who did all this, but they think that he has something to do with this. And if it were him, he would know how to kill and dispose of Amy without leaving any trace behind.
And look, he apparently drove around in a van. He had like a murder van, basically.
Gosh.
Maybe the person who thought they saw a truck actually saw his van. You know,
yeah.
I mean, who knows, right? I think it's strong. I mean, it's a strong suspect, and it fits, and it just doesn't. It's not like Land or Wyoming has a lot of murderers running around, right? So
right.
You almost feel like it would need to be somebody like this who's sort of out hunting. So I think Delwayne Eaton's really strong. It would be great. It's just so unfortunate. There's nothing. You know, it's just nothing to test against, right? Like there's no stray fingerprint. There's no piece of DNA. There's just nothing. I mean, if Delwayne Eaton is listening to this podcast, he should just go ahead and admit to this one because it is so impressive the way he pulled this off.
Right.
So go get your glory, Dale. Admit that you did it, and everybody will celebrate you and how good a serial killer you are. So go ahead. But look, in all seriousness, this is a case. This case can be solved. There has to be somebody who knows something about this case. I just don't believe that it's really the case that no one knows anything about this. So I hope somebody out there is listening and that this has sparked something in your mind and has reminded you of something from 23 years ago in 1997 or a conversation you had with somebody or something. Because this is a case that can be solved and it deserves to be solved. And I feel like there was a lot of attention on this in the beginning. But maybe if we can put a lot of attention on it now, we can actually solve this case. So that is my hope. It's why we wanted to cover this case. It's a really fascinating case, even though there's not a lot of evidence. And I hope you guys can help us make a difference on this one. If you want to reach out to us, if you have any comments, questions, additional information we didn't cover, our address is the same as it always is, prosecutorspod@gmail.com. At Prosecutors Pod for Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Obviously, you can leave us a message on Reddit. You can leave us a message on YouTube. Whatever you want to do. Prosecutorspodcast.com is the website. take a look at that photo because you guys need to see it. It just really proves everything that Cheryl McCollum said on our episode that we did before. But I think that's all we've got on Amy Bechtel today. Alice, do you have anything else you want to add?
Yeah, it's just so unsatisfying. I think this is really one of those cases that we do because we hope someone knows something out there. Like we said, we don't even have more theories to go off of because there's just such a lack of evidence.
No, there really is. There really is, and you're right. It is unsatisfying. You know, it's nice when we end them and we feel like we've reached some sort of conclusion. That is just not the case here. It's not the case here, and it's been something that her family's been struggling with, I know. And look, I mean, I know Steve's moved on, and he's got two beautiful children, and I always think about that, how weird that must be. And Steve talks about this, too, in some of the interviews he did, that, you know, if Amy had never been killed, if she had not been killed, his entire life would be different. And, you know, he wouldn't have the two kids that he has. And that's got to be like, that's got to mess with your head, you know. But everybody deserves to know what happened in this case.
But Brett, I will end on one possible note of hope. After almost all of our episodes, someone will reach out and say something along the lines of, here's something you didn't know before. And sometimes it doesn't really change anything, but sometimes we'll get emails from people who say, I've never told anyone this, but I really think I may know something, and you're the first person I've told, which we are so humbled that you guys would even reach out to us. And as we've told you before, we, you know, we always ask for permission to share the information you're sharing with us. And if you ask it not be shared, we don't share it. So we, you know, have received lots of communications that we don't share because we respect you all in trusting us. So I am hopeful that this will be one of those cases that we will hear something that we don't currently know.
I am as well. And reach out to us. We'll get it to the right people. And if you don't want to talk to the police, you're ready to talk to us, that's fine. So that's all we have for this week. Alice, it's been a pleasure as always. I look forward to doing this with you again next time. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
I was going to say, is this your way of saying that I might get murdered and then you can really shine?
Well, you know, that's not what I'm saying. But sometimes out of tragedy can come beauty. So there you go, Alice.
He was the phoenix from the ashes. Watch your back. Thanks. You're all hearing this, so someone come after me.
I'm going to edit most of this out.
Like I told you at the beginning, we're kind of in a weird mood. I'm not even sure why. A case of the Mondays?
Yeah.